Welcome to our Perimenopause What the F podcast, brought to you by the Peri community. In this podcast, your host, Rachel Hughes, talks everything, and we mean everything, perimenopause. She helps us navigate through all our what the F perimenopause moments and all, is this normal, questions. Rachel talks with perimenopause experts, thought leaders, and inspirational voices of the community. To connect with other perimenopause warriors, download our free Peri app. You can find the link in our show notes. And now, let's dive right in.
Hey everyone, this is Rachel of Rachel Hughes Midlife here with another episode of Peri Talks, where we like to deep dive into all things perimenopause and menopause, bringing you the science and the sisterhood. Welcome all. Today I am speaking with Dr. Mary Jane Minkin on cognition, mood, and sleep in perimenopause. Dr. Minkin is director of the Yale Obstetrical and Gynecological Society and a clinical professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the Yale University School of Medicine. She's also been in private practice in New Haven, Connecticut for more than 40 years. Dr. Minkin is also director of the Sexuality, Intimacy, and Menopause Clinic in the Division of Gynecological Oncology in the Smilo Cancer Center at Yale New Haven Hospital since 2008, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask her more about that too. This is going to be a rich and wildly informative discussion on what for many women is arguably the toughest part of perimenopause: cognition, mood, and sleep. I'm really looking forward to this discussion with Dr. Minkin. For future episodes, make sure you subscribe to this podcast. And now, let's get started.
Hello, it worked. How are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm great.
Technology here.
No, not at all. Take your time, get settled. I was actually just, I was fangirling over you, and I was saying that I'm such a fan, and when I started to research you, and I realized it's that Dr. Minkin. I had this outer body experience. So. Pardon? Oh no, this is such a pleasure, really. Thank you for joining us and the Peri community. I'm Rachel. And let me just let you know briefly also before we get started that anyone who jumps on to the call may ask a question in the chat and I will facilitate that for you, unless you're more comfortable reading it yourself. But typically I do
that's so you don't have to
bother with it. Welcome, Dr. Mary Jane Minkin. So you are also, what I didn't realize, in Connecticut. I am in Connecticut.
Where are you in Connecticut?
I'm in Stamford. Yeah, nice. I'm in Stamford, Connecticut. And I'm going to get started. Thank you so much for being here. Dr. Mary Jane Minkin is a clinical professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the Yale University School of Medicine, and has been in private practice in New Haven for more than 40 years. Dr. Minkin is board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, and she practices at Yale New Haven Hospital. She's a fellow of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and has been a North American Menopause Society certified menopause practitioner since 2002. Dr. Minkin has been director of the Sexuality, Intimacy, and Menopause Clinic in the Division of Gynecological Oncology in the Smilo Cancer Center at Yale New Haven Hospital since 2008. She's also been director of the Yale Obstetrical and Gynecological Society since its inception in 2006. She is a multiple award recipient, nationally known in the field of gynecology, an author, speaker, advisor, a podcaster, Lady Parts, if you are unfamiliar. And as I was just telling the ladies on the call, you have been a guest of two of my personal favorite on-air broadcasters, Judy Woodruff and Faith Middleton. So thank you so much again. Welcome to the Peri community. I was also just mentioning that you're kind of like what I like to say, the original gangster in this niche, you know, that like talking about menopause, talking about perimenopause, talking about women's reproductive health. And I'm curious, before we sort of deep dive into cognition and mood and sleep, if you would share with us a bit of your sort of personal journey as a physician, looking at what I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I imagine to be sort of a gaping hole as it relates to the topic of perimenopause and menopause, and sort of how you've seen that segue into something else. It's certainly been a participant in that happening.
Well, Rachel, thank you very much for all the kind accolades there. That was more than kind. And all it really means is I'm old. That's
no. No, it doesn't. It certainly means you're committed, though. And that I appreciate that. Yeah.
That there's no question. And I'm also old, but it's great because the other good thing, there is one really fabulous thing about turning 70, I can tell you this, is that you can say whatever you want. And anybody says, yeah, I'm 70, shut up. You know?
That's right. You have full permission to let it roll.
Absolutely. So I people said, why, you know, when I was looking forward to it, they said, well, you always say what you want anyway. I said, yeah, but it gives me more legitimate reason to say so. So of course, part of my interest in menopause is sort of in a sense self-serving, because what happens is when you start in practice, you're very young and you're doing a lot of obstetrics, and I love obstetrics. And that's the other thing that I have to qualify. I love being an obstetrician, and delivering babies is really fabulous. It's really a terrific thing to do. But what happens is you get older with your patients getting older. So, you know, as your patients get older, they stop having babies. And now you keep having four young patients in there too. But the women who've had their babies and are now are heading towards some hormonal changes and things like that. And unfortunately, that the study of menopause was not fabulous in the old days. That there wasn't a lot of stuff. And there weren't a lot of products, for example, out there.
Right.
So we didn't have that much in the line of knowledge, and we've been learning much more over the course of time, which is great. But so as we've gained more knowledge and a lot more interest in the topic, also, I mean, we can talk about it from a sociologic perspective, that the study of women's health has become more legitimate, perhaps. Women are a little bit more important out there. And obstetrics and gynecology has become a much more legitimate specialty. One issue to remember is when I was a little kid and finishing up medical school and deciding what to do with my life, and I really was pretty committed to obstetrics and gynecology, many of the people at my medical school who thought I would go into something much more respectable like internal medicine were like, what do you want to go with OBGYN? That's where the dummies go. But it's like, no, I mean, it really was, and there wasn't a lot, the science wasn't totally there, you know, back 50 years ago.
Sure.
Ballpark. And so we've really learned a lot in the last 50 years. It's become a much more respectable, you know, specialty. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that have been going on. And there are a lot of good things happening. And then all of a sudden, when it comes particularly to menopause, is July 9th, 2002 happened.
Right. The infamous.
Some of you may have seen an article that I was quoted in recently about days in my life that I remember. And I can tell you exactly where I was the day Kennedy was shot. I can tell you exactly where I was on 9/11. And I can also tell you exactly where I was when I heard the unembargoing of the WHI report on July 9th, 2001.
Amazing.
Which really upended a lot of the progress we had made in menopause. And the other thing that I am on record is going on for is what not only happened to menopause care, and there's still a lot of research that's been going on, not to worry, but what happened to menopause care was a perfect storm. And why do I say that is, unfortunately, that what was going on in training of house officers, particularly an OBGYN especially, is that we were trying to cut down the training time for residents. Because of the sleep issues and, we can't keep these poor children awake for so many nights and stuff like that. Well, I can tell you it didn't kill me, but anyway, so we had to cut down the training hours. And the problem is we didn't make the residencies any longer. So we just had to cut teaching. And so you have to have, for an OBGYN residency, you have to teach residents how to deliver a baby. You have to teach them how to do a hysterectomy. I mean, there are certain things they have to know. So what became expendable? Menopause education. And the other thing that became expendable, of course, was on July 9th, 2002, with the premature release of the Women's Health Initiative data. What happened is, well, women aren't going to take hormone therapy anymore. Let's not teach menopause.
Wow. Like, fascinating. Okay. Yeah.
So what happened is that became the least favorite child of education. And a lot of, and so it's not the residents' fault. I don't blame them for this. But what happened is they weren't getting the training because the hours were cut, the teaching hours were cut. So what's happened now is any resident who finished their training after 2002, which is a lot of people now, didn't get the training in menopause health because we weren't teaching it. I mean, I was trying to teach it, but
sure.
The formal education programs weren't there. So what's happened is that we have people, and again, the other thing is some of us old farts are beginning to retire. I mean, I have no intention of it, but many people I know are less nuts than I am. Mm-hmm. And so the older people are retiring. And so we have a bunch of younger players who just didn't have the benefit of being educated themselves on menopause. And then the second part of the perfect storm is what's happened is the women who were menopausal in 2002, well, they were like, no, I can't take hormones. They're bad for me. That's a bad thing to do. But now the women who are now turning menopausal, 20 years ago, they weren't paying attention to the WHI. They could have cared less. And I'm not blaming them. Why should they? They were 25, 30 years old. Why should they pay attention to this menopause stuff? No reason.
Yeah.
So you have women now who are going through perimenopause, and they're going to providers, and some providers may have helped deliver their babies and things like that, but they weren't trained on menopause. So it's a perfect storm. So these women are like, well, what do you mean you don't know about this? Well, they don't know about it. And yet these women are suffering and the providers can't help them. It's a tough situation.
It is a tough situation. And I do want to come back to it later. I appreciate all of that. And it sort of is it's a helpful backdrop to all of this, all parts of this conversation. So in preparing to speak with you today and thinking about these three pieces, cognition, mood, sleep, I also, of course, you know, understand how they all sort of bleed into each other and one impacts the other. But I wonder if you could just spend a little time unpacking cognition specifically. And the reason is I think it's one of these terms that we all sort of think we understand what that means, and certainly apply it also when we're speaking about things like brain fog or menopause brain. But I do want to make sure that we all are on the same page and understanding what cognition is, and then of course what starts to happen as we enter into perimenopause.
Well, it's an excellent question, and I don't know if I can give you a good description of cognition.
Okay. fair enough.
I'll make a disclaimer that I am not a psychologist or psychiatrist, nor do I play one on TV. but that it's brain function. And there are many, many, many aspects of brain function as far as memory, as far as working memory, as far as recall, as far as putting thoughts together, as far as recognizing things, understanding, getting new information, remembering old information. There are all these different aspects of it, which I, unfortunately, being just the OBGYN that I am, sort of lumped together. Many women talk about brain fog as being a part of menopause, that their brains just aren't working as well as they used to. Okay. Mm-hmm. They can't remember things. They can't remember sometimes new information. They can't process or remember old information. They get information and they can't process it appropriately. All of these things I tend to lump again, under the aegis of cognition.
Sure. Okay. And then I also want to sort of parse out this piece about adult puberty, which I've heard you speaking about, because it may seem a little unrelated to this, but I don't think that it is, particularly when women start to describe how they're doing or how they're feeling behaviorally. Does that make sense? Can you sort of go into that a bit more?
Sure. And I think it's, I don't think it's a bad analogy to say it is, you know, reverse puberty, because what's happening in somebody who's pre-pubertal going into a pubertal, you know, post-pubertal human being is the fact that the ovaries weren't doing anything to speak of before puberty. And we get these triggers or things to get our ovaries going, but it is not a smooth linear curve, you know, and basically, menopause is basically, and I describe it simply as the pooping out of the ovaries, which is reverse of the turning on of the ovaries. And it is not a linear function going down a smooth ride. And the example that I put on the board, and I must confess, when I teach my kiddies, which I've done for many years, I don't use PowerPoints in general. I do only occasionally, like during this plague here, I've had to use it when I've been doing Zoom teaching and things. But I like to use the blackboard. And I've actually used it in a fair amount of my talks on Zoom, even is my little whiteboard, I guess they call it, whatever. But I draw a sort of a graph, okay? And I draw a very squiggly line that goes down, okay? And the very squiggly line that goes down, I always say, no, I'm going to show you, and I show this to my patients, and this is the Dow Jones Industrial Average in September of 2008. And you'll say, what?
Well, of course, yeah.
It crashed, but it wasn't a straight linear line down. It was squiggly. And what happens in perimenopause is some days your ovaries are working and some days they're not, you know, and over the course of the menopause transition, they will go from a high level of estrogen to a low level of estrogen, but it's not a smooth decline. And it may cycle over the course of months or even years. Okay. And it takes a long time to achieve it. And one of the major problems that's out there is that defining perimenopause. And you ask any menopause doc, it's way easier to take care of postmenopausal people than perimenopausal people. That challenge, postmenopausal ladies, they're easy. That's no problem. The perimenopause is where the real, to me, the real difficulty is as far as treating women. Because you, unless you deliberately stop ovarian activity, which we can do,
right,
you really can't, you know, say to somebody, okay, this is what your ovaries are going to be doing tomorrow. You know, and we can't control what the ovaries are doing. We can deal with the consequences, but we really can't control the ovaries other than stopping them altogether. We can't make it a linear line downwards. So that's part of the problem. And we don't know. I mean, a lot of this is stuff we don't know. What causes the exact ups and downs? We don't know. Okay. What causes a lot of symptomatology? We really don't know, but we do our best to try to deal with it for people. And what's very interesting is that if you look at the menopausal symptoms that occur, they are not smooth along, like you're going to get A, B, C, D, and E, whatever, along those lines. That, for example, the hot flashes, the mood stuff, the sleep issues tend to be worse at the beginning of the perimenopausal transition. And once we get to somebody who's 5 years after their last period, the levels are pretty low. They're low, but they're not squiggly in general, comparatively. For example, the vaginal dryness that many women are prey to, that's easy to explain because that's a direct function of the estrogen levels being low, not the squiggliness. And so, and the dryness can actually occur 2, 3, 4 years after the last period, so much so that many women have no idea that they're experiencing vaginal dryness, and that too is menopause. To them, menopause is the hot flashes, the other symptoms, right, not the dryness. And they're like, no, this is not menopause. Yes, it is. Yeah. But we have to explain it to people. And that's Dr. easy to take care of.
I'm sorry, Dr. Minkin, can we just pause for a minute at that time that you just mentioned, sort of early in the perimenopause journey, if you will? I think, and I hear from, and I personally experienced myself, anxiety, moody blues, feeling kind of unplugged, disconnected, unmotivated. I didn't realize, and I think looking back, I suppose you could say it was due to any number of other things, but I think I feel pretty safe in saying that my experience and from what I've heard from many women at this point, that all of that, they can sort of go now, oh yeah, I think that was my start of perimenopause. Do we know why it sort of shows up cognitively in mood disturbances, at when it does? Why does it look like that in the beginning? Do we know?
We know a little bit. Okay. We don't know a ton necessarily. Okay. And again, you're absolutely right. And what I always say about perimenopause, it's often a retrospective diagnosis. Yeah. You know, when I take care of people for a long period of time, and I'll say, you know how you were feeling 5 years ago? Now that we look back at it, it's probably perimenopause that you were experiencing, but it's hard to say prospectively. And part of the issue that's out there is that you cannot say that somebody, a particular symptom, is menopausal. Okay. And I try to explain this to my med students, to my residents, fellows, whoever wants to listen to me, is the fact that you can't say somebody, what defines them is their perimenopausal state. No, these are people who are going through perimenopause. But the other thing to remember is women at this point, mid 40s, late 40s, early 50s, things like that. And again, that's the other thing, that there is no one time to say somebody is, you know, they're going to go through menopause. We have people doing this in their 30s occasionally. We have people doing this in their late 50s. So it's very hard to define what's going on. And the other things that are happening to women typically at this point in their lives, and I do a lot of speaking to lay groups, and I also tell my residents, use this as a laugh line, it'll get you far. That when I give a talk, I will oftentimes say, well, a lot of stuff is going on to women at this time in their lives. For example, their kids are leaving home. And my next line is, or even worse, coming back.
That always gets I was going to say,
and then over the next part of it is they're having job issues going on. Their partner is having job issues going on, and age discrimination, which we unfortunately deal with in this country. And then the other huge factor that women are now dealing with, which they may not have had to deal with, you know, 50 years ago per se, is our elders are living that much longer, and they are doing elder care. And then my other laugh line is, and you're having to take care of your mother and father, yeah, or even worse, your mother-in-law. Yeah. So that there's huge things that people are dealing with at this point. So it's very hard to dissect and say, this is perimenopause. You know, there are a lot of stressors that people are dealing with, and they may not consciously, it's not evil if they're not thinking about it. They're just dealing with them.
Right.
Well, you know, that they're out there. Now, sometimes I will do an experiment with people. Okay. And oftentimes the experiment I will do, for example, I'm not saying you have to do this by any means, but if somebody's in terrific shape, you know, somebody who eats Sprouts every day and goes to the gym every day and things like that, never smoked a cigarette, I can usually use birth control pills on her, a low dose birth control pill. And what happens when I'm using or prescribing her a birth control pill and she takes it, is I am taking her ovaries out of the question. Her ovaries are going night-night. They're doing nothing, per me, And I am externally controlling her level of estrogen and progesterone, They have synthetic progesterone, not real progesterone, and giving her a fixed level of hormones every day, And I can say, you are now not having hormonal fluctuations. I am in control. I am controlling your hormones. It's like when the computer, when you, share screen or whatever, I'm controlling. I'm controlling her hormones, and we can see how she feels. And if she says, and if her sleep is all better, and her mood is all better, et cetera, we can say, you know what this is? This is your hormones. They're jiggly and stuff like that. But if she's like, nah, I'm still miserable, there's a lot of stuff going on, and my brain still isn't working, and I'm cognitively impaired at this, I can say, well, let's look at the stressor aspects of this, which may be more prevalent than you thought. Now, there are some women who don't do well with birth control pills. We know that. But we can oftentimes get a picture. And oftentimes people may not want to take medications, but if we do this sometimes just for 2 or 3 months as an experiment, then I can say, this looks like your component of this is X, your component of this is Y. So I can try to give her some information that might be helpful for her to help parse things.
Okay. You just segued so well into my next question, really, which is about hormonal support. So low-dose birth control pills. You pointed out something really important I just want to focus on for a second, and that is you would give a low-dose birth control pill to someone who is otherwise very, very healthy. And I think that's important for us to understand, even for those of us who might walk into our gynecologist's office and say, I think I might want to try a low-dose birth control pill. can she make that determination on her own based on what? That she has never smoked, that she eats really well, blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Somebody can't be a smoker. We can't give birth control pills to smokers over 35. That we can't do. Somebody who's significantly overweight, not a great idea. Somebody who's had clotting problems. She's had, you know, her family has a lot of clotting problems. She's had blood clots. No, we can't use it. Her blood pressure is not in good control. But if you have somebody whose blood pressure is good, she's not super, you know, super heavy. She's not a smoker, never had clots. Many of those people can take a low dose pill.
And this is also, sorry, I just want to make sure I'm threading the needle correctly. Sure. This is also addressing someone who's come in and said, I'm really bummed all the time. I don't feel myself. I feel a lot of anxiety. It's all of these mood behavior. Maybe she's also saying, I'm not sleeping like I used to. And let's say she's 48 and she's still getting a period. Is she also a candidate for a low dose birth control pill?
Yeah, as long as she's in good health and she's not a smoker and not significantly overweight. Now, I must confess that I'm perhaps a little more liberal along those lines than other people. You know, some people are very anxious, you know, doctors, and I can't yell at them for being anxious about it. The doctors won't, you know, and I can't blame the doctor for not doing it. But in general, if somebody is in pretty good shape, I think that's a reasonable option. Now, one thing one can also do, and this is an option, you know, okay, for people who don't feel comfortable themselves taking the pill or their provider doesn't feel comfortable prescribing the pill, because there is an increased risk of blood clots with birth control pills. Mm-hmm. We have to say that. That's for anybody, you know, okay, mm-hmm. even the healthiest person who's eating sprouts out there. Mm-hmm. But that just exists out there. But one thing for most people, again, who are in the healthy category, but again, have a doctor who's a little anxious about this or something like that, we can always use, we can often use, for example, an amount of transdermal estrogen, an estrogen patch.
Okay.
And the reason I say the patch is sort of an experimental thing, it does not increase the risk of blood clots. Basically, an oral estrogen has a slight, very slight increased chance of giving you a blood clot. Transdermal estrogens seem not to. Do I have prospective randomized data? I do not. I have observational trials that show us that. But you can try it for a short period of time. And you can put somebody, throw them on a patch. Now, what you're not doing is you're not going to, if somebody's ovaries are really going crazy, that will not shut down her ovaries. Okay. But what it will do is like a rising tide floats all boats. It will raise her estrogen level every day, whether it's one of her estrogen making days or whether her estrogen not making days. So for example, if I give somebody a patch, she may come in a few weeks later and say, my breasts are killing me. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what's going on is on the days that she's making a good amount of estrogen, she's still getting the estrogen from the patch. So she's getting a super amount of estrogen that day. Now she ain't going to get breast cancer from it. She doesn't have to worry about it, but her breasts may be sore. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now what you're doing though, is you're raising the level, you know, so that her down days are not profoundly low. And that oftentimes she'll be able to discern out and say, yeah, but I don't have the real downs. My breasts may be sore sometimes, but my downs are better.
And by down days, are we talking about mood? Or are we talking about lower estrogen days?
We go both. I mean, for some people, if her mood changes are related to her low estrogen, that may give you some inclination. You know, information may give you some information at that.
Dr. Menken, I'm wondering, as I'm listening to you, and I keep sort of visualizing this random patient coming into your office, and for someone who has had a lifetime of really bad PMS, maybe she was diagnosed with PMDD, maybe she's been diagnosed with depressive disorder, as a younger woman, a woman under, I don't know what you would consider young, 35, you know, younger than perimenopause years or something like that on average. What is there for her, and what is maybe a safe recommendation for her?
Well, again, the thing to remember is that menopause can be a challenge for people with a history of major depressive disorders. And we seem to have the statistic out there that for women who have a woman who has a history of a major depressive disorder, going through menopause increases her risk of getting another major depressive disorder threefold. Okay.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
If you've had a significant history of major depressive disorder, please do tell your, if you're going to see a new gynecologist, somebody that doesn't know you, hasn't been taking care of you for ages and stuff like that, and say, by the way, when I was 30 or 35, I was diagnosed with a major depressive disorder. Thank goodness it's better now. But you know, now that I'm 10 or 15 years later, I'm beginning to have some of those feelings. That's important for that doctor to know about. Nurse, and again, the other thing I always want to say, nurse practitioner, nurse midwives, PAs can be extraordinarily excellent providers in this situation. You don't have to have an MD to help take care of menopause. And many of our, and we'll talk about menopause specialists in a minute, many of the members of the North American Menopause Society are nurse practitioners, yeah. PAs. And they've done the menopause certification and they're experts on the field. So it doesn't have to be an MD. And sometimes you'll get a better visit with a nurse practitioner who has more time to discuss these issues with you than the typical 5-minute MD visit, which
yeah,
I unfortunately
yeah.
Out.
Thank you for saying that. That's really
so,
important.
You know, nurse practitioners and PAs can be absolutely fabulous. Mm-hmm. So that's an important thing to remember. But anyway, it's important to share that information about your past depressive history because that's important to know that that may be coming out for you. So that's something to be aware of.
Okay. And as far as, someone who perhaps has Alzheimer's, sort of in the family, if you will, how are we thinking or how should we be thinking about hormonal support? And as it relates to sort of boosting us cognitively, helping deflect any memory issues down the line, this kind of thing. I hear a lot of opposing arguments.
There are a lot of opposing arguments because literature is all over the place. Okay. What I can say to somebody, and this I have data on, okay. I can say to somebody, if you're 15 years postmenopausal, have not taken any estrogen, and now you're saying to yourself, gee, I'm 65 years old right now, or I'm 67, which of course is very young as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, but of course, if you're a young 65 or 67 saying, gee, I just found out that my Aunt Susie had dementia, and I'm concerned about that. Can I start taking estrogen to help prevent it? No. It will not help prevent it. That I can confidently say. You do not want to start estrogen therapy many years postmenopausal.
Okay.
There is very controversial data about does taking estrogen early. On my last period was a year ago. My mother had dementia. I want to take it for prevention. Okay. I don't know. Literature is all over the place. I cannot say we have definitive literature to say that estrogen will help prevent it. There is some literature that suggests that, but it is hardly definitive. There's other literature that says, no, it doesn't. It probably won't make it a higher risk, but there's no definitive literature to say that it prevents it. Now, I want to add one important thing. Anybody listening to this who is 35 years old, and if you just had your ovaries taken out, I don't care if you're feeling fabulous. No, of course I care that you're feeling fabulous. It's great that you're feeling fabulous, but you need to be on estrogen. Okay. You're 35 years old, you had your ovaries taken out, and you have no contraindications to estrogen therapy. Okay. You want to be talking to your doctor about going on estrogen. We have very nice data from the Mayo Clinic. Okay. A respectable outfit. I've heard of them. So the key thing is that we have very nice data, and that's not the only batch of data we have, that if you are 35 years old, you have your ovaries out and you don't take estrogen, you are increasing your risk of getting dementia threefold.
Wow. Okay.
So yes, if you are 35, please go talk to your doctor tomorrow or then that's the weekend. But anyway,
note of it.
But for your average person who's 50, 51, data is not clear.
So this is a little bit maybe in the minutia kind of a question, but so you do not want to start estrogen therapy when you're many years postmenopausal. Mm-hmm. However, if you have been using estrogen therapy and you started it, 48, I keep throwing out 48. Can you just keep on with it?
Well, this is again a controversy.
Okay.
Personally, what I can say is we have no data long-term. My senior partner and I were discussing this a couple of weeks ago, and I love working with my senior partner because he's 8 years older than I am, and he's still actively taking care of patients in fabulous ways. And he's saying, wouldn't it be great if we had data, on women who started taking it at 48 and are now in their 70s? What about looking at it? And the answer is we don't have that data. And those studies are really hard to do. And I don't know that we're ever going to have that data out there. Mm-hmm. We don't have studies that say, oh my goodness, it's dangerous. Okay. Do we know that there's perhaps a very slight increased risk of breast cancer in people who are using estrogen plus progestin? Okay. And I have, we can go into qualifications there of people who've had a hysterectomy versus people who have not had a hysterectomy. But we just don't have a lot of long-term data. My attitude is if somebody's doing well and they want to stay with it, I'm okay by keeping it going. I'm happy to keep it going for them.
Okay.
Would I push them to say that I've got great data to show this is going to help you prevent heart disease? I don't, okay. But I certainly think their risks are minimal.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that. Dr. Minkin, I'm going to pause our mood, cognition, sleep, which I want to get to, because we have a few questions that have come in and I want to address those for people who are on the call. Going back to the first one, someone asked for clarification. Did you say that no doctors trained after 2002 have gotten training in menopause, or was that specific to OBGYNs?
That's specific to OBGYN training, but I can tell, and I can't say no, okay, that basically as of 2013, 20%, one of my buddies did a study on this, that 20% of the residency programs were offering menopause education, a formal curriculum. Now, it doesn't mean that the 80% of kids who were not exposed to a formal curriculum didn't learn. I mean, people could learn. Okay. I trust my residents learned.
Okay. Sure.
But in general, they were not offered the formal training that folks trained earlier were. That I can say.
Thank
and
you.
Again, the other thing is anybody can train to become a certified menopause practitioner.
Thank you for reminding of that. Yes. And, yes.
And so if you are, and this is probably the most important thing I can convey to people, if you're like, I'm not happy with the information I'm getting, my provider really did not have the training, I'm anxious about this, there's a great way to find a practitioner. You go to menopause.org, which is the website of the North American Menopause Society, which is a very good website anyway. And you can plug in your zip code and you will get a listing of all the certified menopause practitioners in your area, members of the North American Menopause Society, people who are actively interested in menopause.
Terrific. Thank you. Next, someone asked, I have a question about vaginal dryness. I've always assumed dryness was referring to the inner canal, but I've been experiencing dryness on the outer vagina. Is this indicative of low estrogen?
Usually, yes. Now, there are other dermatological conditions which can cause dryness, or for example, somebody who takes a bunch of antihistamines on every daily basis, which some of us do for allergies, that can dry you out too. But menopause can also give you dryness on your vulva as well. And if you're using, I mean, there are some over-the-counter remedies that can be helpful. And of the vaginal type estrogens, you probably want to use a cream as opposed to a suppository, because the vaginal suppositories of estrogen are lovely and they're not messy, but they really take good care of the inner part of the vagina. But if this is really external dryness, you'll probably benefit by a topical estrogen cream.
Great. Thank you. And finally, someone asks, how does perimenopause affect Graves' disease?
Excellent question. And in general, it's not a huge effect. I mean, again, you want to keep following. And if you're taking hormonal intervention, you have to follow your thyroid levels very appropriately, because there may be differences in binding globulins and things like that. But you want to make sure you're going to an endocrinologist who's handling this for you, and they will be taking good care of your levels.
Great. Thank you. Another question just came in. Sorry, Dr. Minkin. If you take hormones, is it just working to delay the process or generally helping to avoid the effects of menopause overall?
That's an excellent question. And the answer is no. It's not just, it's not like you're doomed to have 5 years of misery or something like that. No. It should hopefully take you through till the miserable phase is beyond. Mm. Now, there are women who are taking hormonal therapy, and when they taper off, and I'll talk about that in a second, they get symptoms, and that can happen, but it's not like you're delaying the inevitable. And hopefully the symptoms you get will be much milder than you would have had 5 years previously. So keep that in mind. Now, the bad news, and I would never, ever, ever lie to a patient, okay? Sometimes I tell my residents, don't give people bad news deliberately. Like if they didn't bring it up, don't have to bring it up. But hot flashes can last for a long time. Yeah. The average duration that people officially quote these days is 7.4 years. It's average. However, about 10% of women will experience hot flashes going on for 10 or more years. I hate to tell people that.
Yeah, no. That's important to know. And thank you for bringing that up. And I have heard that anecdotally, just from people in my life and friends of my mother's and stuff like that, who were, 80 and still hot flashing, which may be an outlier, but I don't know. Okay. Getting back to the topic at hand, could you just sort of tell us about executive function issues, sort of how this may show up? And if you would, the discussion around ADHD and ADHD, I guess, drug support or maintenance, I'm not sure how you'd phrase it, drugs. Are these things that you would recommend to patients? Should they go speak to someone to get a definitive diagnosis? That seems blurry.
It is blurry. And it's a good question. We'll talk about the ADHD aspects. In general, if I have somebody whose cognition is awful, whatever, mm-hmm. they're awful, mm-hmm. memory, stuff like that. And again, we're going to talk a little bit about sleep as well, because sleep makes everything worse, mm-hmm. being a poor sleeper. Mm-hmm. And with menopause, many, many women have insomnia. And it's not I'm having a tough time falling asleep. It's that they fall asleep because they're exhausted. But at 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, they're like, they're wide awake. Right. And whether they wake up with a hot flash or then wake up first and then get the hot flash, who knows? But that basically, and then an hour or two later, they'll fall back to sleep, and then boom, they'll get another hot flash, and they're getting very disrupted sleep. Well, that's not so good for your brain. Okay. So there are things that people do. For example, there's this CBTI apps that people use all the time, cognitive behavioral therapy things, which is highly recommended in the menopause community. There are some herbal products that can help. Certainly estrogen therapy can help with this to help buy people some sleep. And sometimes your sleep aids will help. So if we get people some sleep, I try to get people sleep to see if I can get their brains working better, by buying them some sleep and see if that makes their brains function better.
Okay.
And if it does and they're fine, great. That's terrific. Okay. If they're not, then I will ship them over to a psychiatrist to say, let's see, because I must confess, I don't feel comfortable prescribing ADHD meds because, my patients all want me to, but I say, listen, I will consider myself, I don't think I'm more knowledgeable, but I think I'm as knowledgeable as anybody in the country about different hormonal supports. I know that, but I don't know these drugs. I don't know them in and out. And I think somebody who's a psychiatrist is going to know this far better than I will, as far as giving you some guidance. And a person whose work, and I just looked this up yesterday or 2 days ago for one of my patients, she has plenty of stuff on the web, okay, is a woman named C, her first name is Cynthia, but nobody calls her that, C.Neill, N-E-I-L-L, Epperson, E-P-P-E-R-S-O-N. And Dr. Epperson is a psychiatrist. She has she doesn't have OB boards, but she has a joint appointment in the OB department as well. She used to be at Yale, which is when I had the privilege of working with her. But she's now, they stole her away to Colorado. She's the chairman of the psych department at University of Colorado. And she has written extensively on things like ADHD type issues in perimenopause and menopause. And so there's a lot of her work out there. And I tend to defer to my psych colleagues on prescribing these meds because I don't consider myself an expert on them.
Dr. Minkin, do you feel, you said something a moment ago about so many of your patients want you to prescribe ADHD medication for them. Do you feel, have you observed anecdotally or otherwise, are you hearing from your patients that they feel, what is going on? What are they experiencing that causes them to feel, I think I have ADHD?
They have trouble getting themselves organized in the day. They used to be able to do 27 things at once and they can't anymore. Now it may just be the fact that they're living up to reality.
Right.
And you used to have extraordinary energy and now you don't. So it can be just that. But they feel their brains aren't working clearly. They can't multitask, whereas they used to be able to multitask, they feel. These are the kinds of things that I hear for them. Their memory's not good. They're having trouble functioning. They're having trouble organizing their days. These are the kind of things that I hear regularly.
Okay. Sorry. I'm just looking at a question. Someone asked, am I asking you, Dr. Minkin, about prescribing ADHD meds for perimenopause cognitive issues or for ADHD issues and perimenopause? That's a great question. And I think that's what I'm trying to sort of parse out is what's happening for people that, what are you hearing? And
I can't parse it out for you.
Okay. No, that's fair. That's fair. And I think part of the issue, like, so, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, like so many of these issues, there's this very blurry thing happening, and it can be happening for any number of reasons. And as we're in or going through perimenopause, all kinds of things are happening anyway. And maybe it's, you know, maybe we can't do the 27 things we used to do, thankfully, right? But it doesn't feel that way anymore. And we're struggling with attention. We're struggling with making decisions, following through. I don't know, whatever it might look like. And so it becomes sort of more, it's just a really difficult thing to kind of make sense of. Does that make sense?
Extremely difficult to say. And the answer is it's very, and a lot of this stuff, and that's why, you know, some of my colleagues frown on me for doing empirical type therapies. Mm. And my attitude, and again, it's I actually started the day by giving grand rounds at Rutgers. No, I wasn't in New Jersey.
Okay.
Zoom grand rounds this morning in New Brunswick, wow. New Jersey, but now I'm here in Connecticut. What can I say? And, you know, one of the things that I always, and today, by the way, we don't teach people who are going into medicine Latin, which is another terrible thing. Mm. But anyway, one of my favorite phrases is primum non nocere secundum benefacere. And what that translates from the Latin is first do no harm, second do good. So if I have an intervention that I think is pretty innocuous and is going to give me some information, I'll do it. You know, okay. I can't blame a doc if they say, what are you doing that for? That's crazy. That's stupid. You know, okay. Well, you know, it may be stupid, but hopefully give me some information and give my patients some information. But I can't blame somebody if they don't want to do it. But I oftentimes will try something to say, let's see if this helps you, you know, without having a definitive diagnosis in there. And I cannot blame him. Please do not blame any provider. You know, I heard Mary Jane say this. Well, some of the stuff that I'm saying is just peculiar to me and some other providers, but I can't blame somebody who says, well, you know, where's your data to do this? And some of my buddies feel very strongly along those lines. Yeah. So I can't blame people that way. But sometimes I feel that I can help somebody say, well, this is what it clearly isn't, because I gave you this and it didn't make a damn bit of difference.
Yeah.
You know? For example, if somebody says, oh, it's cause of menopause, I know this is menopause, and I know their lives are absolutely berserk, you know, and they're stressed out beyond belief, but oh, no, I know this is menopause. I'll say, you know, let me put an estrogen patch on you for 2 months and let's see what happens. You know, okay. And she comes in 2 months later and said, no difference. It didn't do anything. I think I can comfortably say to her, it makes it a lot less likely. I can't say zero chance, but it makes it a lot less likely this is menopause. Let's talk to your therapist about this.
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
Let's emphasize that the estrogen didn't really help you at all. And you've got a lot of stressors going on there, my friend. And let's see if we can deal with some of these stressors. You know, so that's the kind of information that sometimes you can get from some of these trials. But if something's going to be dangerous, no, I'm not going to try something that's really dangerous. I'm not going to give a cigarette smoker, you know, who smokes 2 packs a day birth control.
Right. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. There's so many more questions coming in and I have a couple left myself, but just to follow up with that ADHD, Deanna also comments, I wonder if standardized psychometric testing could help with parsing it out. Maybe see a neuropsychologist.
Yeah, it may well help. But sometimes neuropsychiatrists are few and far between.
Yeah.
So the answer is yes, I think it would help. Absolutely. And I think in the best of all possible worlds, you know, okay, that one would have a full evaluation by a menopause expert and a neuropsychiatrist, you know, to see what they think is going on. Unfortunately, in practicality, that probably isn't going to happen too often.
Okay. Back to another question from someone here on the call. What do you recommend for vaginal canal dryness? Intercourse is so painful.
Lots of stuff out there. And one thing, if I can put in an advertisement, an unpaid political advertisement, please go to my exciting website, which is madamovary.com. French
spelling. It is an exciting website.
OVARY.com. And start with my vaginal dryness podcast. And as I tell them, well, ladies, what could be more exciting than a vaginal experience? So anyway, and we also have videos too. If you like videos, they're great too. What can I tell you? And so that'll give you a good review of what's out there. We have over-the-counter remedies, which are pretty good. Thank you much. Thank you much. I see that coming up in the chat. We have a lot of over-the-counter remedies, which will work. They're all outlined in Madam Overy there. There's also many medications that are quite helpful. There are a lot of vaginal estrogen products, a vaginal DHEA product. There are a lot of products out there that will help. Unfortunately, the one thing that I have to warn anybody, and I gave this part of the lecture this morning in my talk in New Jersey, that unfortunately, all vaginal estrogens come with a package insert that has a bunch of scary things from the FDA. The FDA has put in all the systemic estrogen warnings, which are way overblown, in the vaginal estrogens, which is a little crazy. And we've been trying to get the FDA to take these guidelines out of the package insert, but they haven't yet. And we don't see any light at the end of the tunnel yet to have that happen. Right. So do talk to your provider who's prescribed this for you. But the amount of estrogen that gets absorbed into the bloodstream from vaginal estrogen is minuscule. Mm-hmm. It is so minuscule that the North American Menopause Society, the American College of OBGYNs have both written in their official position statements that somebody who has breast cancer, not worried about getting breast cancer, but actually has breast cancer, may safely use vaginal estrogens because the amount that gets absorbed is so small. So people shouldn't worry about it. It's quite effective. You do need a prescription. It's not over the counter. But if you have tried over the counters and they have failed, I don't want you to have a problem thinking about using vaginal estrogen and talk with your provider about getting a script for that.
Terrific. Thank you. And finally, there's one more question. Are there studies of long-term effects of menopause in women who go through naturally versus using hormone therapy? Are there more health disturbances due to the effects of menopause specifically on the brain and heart?
How many hours do we have to discuss that?
Listen, I will stay as long as you want to.
I'm fine. What I can say is that the WHI study, again, we have some stuff on Madam Overy about that, that basically, if we look at the 18-year follow-up, which came out a couple of years ago, as far as following these women up, and there was actually no difference whatsoever as far as nobody died quicker or anything like that. There was no increase in mortality. And actually, a couple of the groups had decreased mortality in the estrogen users. Now, these weren't using them for 18 years. They had been part of the study earlier, and then they were observed long term. But we can honestly say that the women who were in the estrogen group of the WHI, particularly in the ladies who had a hysterectomy, who were just taking estrogen and were not taking estrogen plus progestin, that actually they had a lower mortality from breast cancer and a lower mortality from Alzheimer's disease than the control.
Wow. Okay.
So that's just the WHI. I'm not telling you that you should take it for these indications. Sure. Please don't get me wrong. But I'm just saying, if you look at that data and it's in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, and it's a couple of years ago now, maybe 3 years ago, something like that, the 18-year follow-up of the WHI data. So I can say there's no increase in mortality, and a couple of specific areas had a slight decrease in mortality.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Minkin, I really want to respect your time. I have a few more questions I want to try and slide in there. Sure. The first one is circling back to mood. Another very sort of sticky dialogue, if you will, in this niche, in this community, is around the use of antidepressants. And again, having spoken with several women who've said, well, my doctor said I should go on an antidepressant. I really don't want to do that. I'm going to find another doctor. And I hear that a lot now. I don't know that that was so 20, 30, 40 years ago, but I certainly hear it a lot now. And I'm wondering sort of what your thoughts are about it. And also I'm curious about the effectiveness of antidepressants in women who are in perimenopause versus postmenopause?
That's an excellent question. And in general, to be honest, the mood stuff does tend to get better once one becomes fully menopausal. Perimenopause seems to be the highest risk for the depressive symptoms, et cetera. Once you get to full menopause, it does tend to get better. That I can tell you, there's light at the end of the tunnel for many people. Antidepressants are also used as anti-hot flash drugs. Yeah, okay. There's significant data. Yeah. There is significant data to show that certain antidepressants, most antidepressants, SSRIs, most SSRIs and most SNRIs actually have anti-hot flash activity. So if you're depressed and you're having miserable hot flashes, it may not be the world's worst thing to do.
Interesting.
The problem that I have with using antidepressants instead of estrogen therapy, okay, as a modality, is unfortunately two of the complaints I hear about a lot from women are weight gain and loss of libido, are two very common complaints that women in the perimenopause transition complain about. And unfortunately, many of the antidepressants are attended by an increase in weight. And
yes. Sure.
So it's like, am I doing these people a favor? Now, there is one SSRI that's approved officially at a very small dose. It's a 7.5 milligram dose of paroxetine, which is also known as Paxil. And the drug happens to be called Brisdelle, B-R-I-S-D-E-L-L-E. It's a tiny dose. It is not going to help your depression. It's a very, very low dose. But it has been shown to help with hot flashes and not put weight on because it's such a tiny dose.
Interesting.
But you can use higher doses and it will help for your hot flashes for many people. And it will help for your mood for many people. It may make you gain a little bit of weight and it may interfere with your libido. So, you know, I have to be honest and tell my people, this is the pluses, this is the minuses. Now, I do want to tell you about a study that was done through the NIMH, National Institutes of Mental Health, a number of years ago, okay? And Peter Schmidt, who's the head of the NIMH, excellent investigator, did this trial. And they basically looked at women who were depressed in perimenopause. This is the group you're talking about. And he gave them, the particular drug he used was sertraline or Zoloft. And he gave these women Zoloft, and some responded and some didn't, okay? He then took the non-responders, I mean, asking them if they wanted to continue their participation. And in the non-responders, he gave half of them estrogen and half of them got placebo. Okay, randomized prospective double-blind trial. And what was very interesting is that the women who got the estrogen in conjunction with the Zoloft, many of them now seem to respond to the Zoloft and they were chipper. So there certainly is some data to suggest that estrogen may help augment the antidepressive activity of some antidepressants, okay? And so some women who were, you would say, refractory to the SSRI may gain some susceptibility and feel chipperer in going with the estrogen and the SSRI. There is some data to that effect.
Interesting. I feel like, and this is not to put any physician down, I do feel like as I'm listening to you through this hour that there is truly something to be said for going on to the NAMS website and finding a certified practitioner. I just think it's a different conversation to have with someone who's gone through that menopause training.
Well, again, the other thing is, though, some people are very interested in menopause who haven't done the full training, but they are interested.
Fair.
They might be a member of NAMS, but not. And again, there are people who aren't members of NAMS. I don't want to say somebody who's not a member of NAMS is not certified or qualified. But people who have a specific interest in it probably will have read more about it and stuff like that to, you know, to help.
Just finally to touch on sleep a bit more, you spoke about sort of addressing sleep initially with your patients who particularly with the ADHD and feeling sort of unplugged and disorganized and executive function issues. How might you suggest this? Where can someone start who's really having sleep issues?
Look at these CBTI apps on the phone. They're big, big in menopause land, and some people find them helpful, you know, and go through the good sleep hygiene people. Some people have terrible sleep hygiene. So looking into some CBTI stuff, they go through sleep hygiene, and that's all good to do. I don't want you sitting on your iPhone there, you know, and then say, okay, it's time to go to bed, and I'm going to go to bed. No, your brain's been buzzing. You ain't going to go to bed. And don't keep the damn phone next to your bed. Put it away. Most people, I mean, unless you're maybe the president of the United States or something like that, you know, you have to make a decision quick, but most of the things will wait till the morning. So anyway, so that's one thing. There are, as I said, there are some over-the-counter remedies that will help. And again, I have to confess, I consult for this company that makes this product, but I consulted for them after I was using their product for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There is one over-the-counter product that I think can be very helpful. There's a German product called Remifemin, R-E-M-I-F-E-M-I-N, okay, which is a German black cohosh product. You can get it at CVS or Walmart or whatever. It's imported here. It's not a prescription. And it's the reason I'm sending you to Germany via Walmart or whatever is the fact that, unfortunately, our herbal products in the United States are not very well supervised, whereas in Germany, they'll throw you in jail if you screw around, which is
right. What should,
but anyway.
Right.
So the key thing is that you want to get a purified product. The folks in Germany, and by the way, these are the most popular products in German breast cancer centers, because, you know, I do work, you know, with, as I said, I do a fair amount of work with breast cancer survivors, mm-hmm. So that I can't use estrogen in. So that Remifemin is used widely in Germany, and they make something called Remifemin Goodnight, which you probably won't be able to find at your Walmart, whatever, because some do have it, but most don't. And the Remifemin Goodnight you can get on Amazon. And this is the German black cohosh product, plus some sleep herbs, again, which are purified. Again, they're on the German list E monograph. They have some valerian, they have some lemon balm, they have some hops, of course, it's German. But it's a reasonable sleep product, and it does help some of my patients sleep at night. So it's very widely used in German breast cancer centers. We use it regularly in my breast cancer center for sexuality and menopause. And it does help a lot of people. So I think that's something you can do without it, you know, and pretty much everybody can take it. It's not a big deal. And to see if it helps you sleep. And if it helps you sleep, God bless you, that's terrific. You know, I'm happy if you're sleeping better. That's mm-hmm. a good thing. Mm-hmm. But if you start saying, I'm doing the CBTI app, it ain't doing anything for me. I got my phone away. I'm doing all the right sleep hygiene. Trying Remifemin Goodnight. I am still waking up at 1 and 2 in the morning. I would talk to your provider, you know, and say, what else can I do to help my sleep to get me through this perimenopause and get me. And again, the sleep oftentimes will get better through perimenopausal transition. It will get better once you get to the other side. Some people it lasts for a while. But again, there are things that we can do to help. And estrogen therapy does tend to help a lot of people.
Yeah.
So that's something you may, if you can take it, you may want to consider it.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Minkin, finally, just to kind of tack back to my first question about kind of where you've seen this entire conversation go. I'm wondering, between you and your colleagues, all the work that you do, what's missing? Where do you feel, what needs more attention in this conversation? Not necessarily about cognitive health, but menopause, perimenopause in general.
I think it's terrific that we're talking about it now. I think there's been a lot more attention paid in the last, you know, few years. And I think part of the issue, and I've told this to anybody that listened to me, I've told this to, is that now you have women who are now perimenopausal and menopausal, and these are the women who aren't getting the answers. And they're now raising their voices and saying, you know, hey, you know, I need help. You know, somebody needs to help me. And so I think that the people asking the questions are driving the conversation and getting things done and having people talk about it.
Right.
And so I think things are happening. I think, I mean, I'm not saying I never stopped teaching menopause, but I think I'm getting a little more attention than teaching menopause.
Yeah. Well, we're grateful for it. What's next for you, Dr. Minkin? Everyone should please jump on Dr. Minkin's website, madamovary.com. It's a fantastically rich and informative landing spot. And I would like to get on your calendar maybe later in the year and talk more about your work. We didn't get to discuss it, although I think I mentioned it in the beginning, at your sexuality, intimacy, and menopause clinic, your work with breast cancer patients. I think that would be just a delight for
yes,
us.
Yes, and again, to promote Madam Overy, if you have those questions, we have an exciting podcast on that particular issue and an exciting video on that particular issue. So tune in.
Terrific. Thank you. This has just been such a pleasure for me. I could go on and on. I just love listening and learning from you and the community. I'm so grateful so many people were here and connected with you in this call. Thank you so much, Dr. Minkin. It was just a pleasure.
And thank you all for listening and participating and asking excellent questions. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the weekend. Thank you, everybody. Be well.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to our Perimenopause What the F podcast. The perimenopause journey can be lonely, and it doesn't have to be that way. Make sure to download our free Peri app to connect with perimenopause warriors in the same stage of life. See you next time, Peri sisters.